Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast, the podcast where we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope that it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors of sexual abuse too. We hope that you find it interesting, but more than that, if you are a survivor of sexual abuse, we hope that you find our discussion empowering. Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Alan Collins. I'm the head of the abuse team at Hugh James, and I'm joined by my colleague, Danielle Vincent. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Alan.
And it gives us great pleasure to have on our podcast, Janita Nichols. Hi, Janita.
Hey, Alan. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And Janita, I believe that you are in Texas.
Yes.
Yeah, very nice too. And what's it like today in Texas?
It's warm. It's very warm. It's a great welcome from the cold couple of days that we have. So I have to be grateful that it's only a couple of days versus weeks and months for everyone else.
Well, here we are in, you know, the UK, and it's the middle of winter and the nights are considerably longer than the days. But the days are getting a little bit longer, so we've got to look a bit more on the positive side. Anyway, Janita, well, thanks for coming on. And you're the author, are you not, of a rather interesting novel, which I believe is called The Secrets of My Mother.
Yes, sir. Yes, I am.
So I thought we'd have a little chat about your novel in a moment. But you've got an interesting background, haven't you? Because you've been a police officer.
Yes, sir.
So for our listeners, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you became a police officer, and then perhaps take us to how you became a novelist.
Okay. So I began my career as a police officer in 2014. That was probably my lifelong dream, was to get into law enforcement and military and just kind of that disciplined background and be able to help and serve people. And as a child coming from the abuse that I came from, I felt like that was going to be the closest way I can come in contact with children and other people who have been abused and kind of make a difference. So I did about 5 years of policing. And while I was a police officer, I did have the, you know, opportunity to come in contact with a lot of people who were abused. I came in contact with abusers. And this whole time, you know, I'm thinking that I have this segue of being able to help them, but really you spend a couple minutes of whether arresting or transporting, and then you leave their presence, never able to make any type of real impact. And that bothered me.
Yeah.
I used to carry that home a lot, of not feeling like I did enough. And so I always had this void of feeling like something was missing from the equation that I was supposed to do. I'm not sure what help they got on the other end, but in 2019, I felt like I had an awakening from God to where it was my time to leave Cincinnati. And I assumed that I was coming to Austin to become a police officer. And when I got here, you know, God kind of got me to an isolated place to where he showed me that my purpose was to share my story. And that was going to be the way for me to reach people, was speaking out about the secrets that I was holding, removing the mask from the image, you know, that I tried to keep for people, and truly confronting the things that occurred in my past and having the boldness to speak out. And that's kind of where my story began, of writing it.
Okay. Well, there's 1,001 questions sort of burning away on all of that. So do I take it that you grew up in Ohio, Cincinnati?
Yeah. Cincinnati, yes.
Yeah. And you had tragically an abusive childhood.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And so when did you have that sort of awakening, so to speak, to become a police officer?
So as a child, I was very troubled. I was very troubled. I got into a lot of trouble. I ended up being incarcerated at the age of 16 due to my behavior and fighting and a lot of lashing out that I did. And I ended up in jail, and it was a police officer there that was just, she was very impactful for me. It was a lot of things that she said, and her composure and her discipline, I kind of honored that, you know, like I was like, I would love to have that type of disposition one day. And as I got older, you know, I didn't have discipline. I didn't have structure. I ended up in high school, one of the 6 high schools that I ended up at And there was an ROTC program. It was the Navy ROTC. And because no one would let me in any other programs, they told me I needed to go to that one to kind of, you know, have some discipline. And I fell in love with it. I loved everything about it. I know that we were being yelled at and all these different things, but the discipline of it, I don't know. It just I gravitated towards it.
So who runs this? The Navy?
It was a junior Navy program. So it's like in high school where you have like music class and like things like that. It was like a junior Navy to where you have like the structure of the military, not really military, but it's structured after the military, like the ranking and the promotions and stuff. But it's a high school program to kind of get you into the introduction of if you were to really go to the military. And so they had that in the school and we was able to wear the uniforms. We ended up being able to travel to like a Navy base to see what it's really like and boot camp and things like that. So I just fell in love with it. It was something I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. And then Law and Order, my mother used to watch Law and Order and my grandmother. It's like a crime show.
Oh, yeah. I'm a fan. The older programs, the more original series were better than the more recent ones. But anyway, I digress.
And I fell in love with that, too. Like the detective work, Olivia Benson was like my favorite. I idolized her. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to go to the military and then I want to come out and I want to be a detective. And that was kind of where it started. So when I turned about 18, 19, I didn't really have the structure. I was still getting into a lot of trouble. About 19, I ended up getting into church and just trying to just get my life together. I'm like, I'm all over the place. I need to kind of center myself and get my life together. And that's where my spiritual relationship began, you know, with God, of just, you know, praying and meditating. Because for a long time, I didn't believe in God or anything like that, but it gave me discipline and structure. So I began there. And then when they began hiring for the police departments, I just began training and just trying out for them.
Right. And the police were able to take you even though you'd been in trouble.
So, apparently, by the grace of God, I guess, when I was a juvenile, they never put it on my record because I guess at the time I was in the system as a I was in what they call like state custody. I was removed from my parents because of my abuse. Yeah. So I guess they looked at that as like a placement after I got kicked out of the last group home versus actually being like a charge or a conviction. Right. So that ended up being it. And so that was the only time I had ever come in contact with police. So I pretty much had a clean record as a juvenile and as an adult. So.
And so as a police officer, you clearly had a lot of contact with victims and survivors of abuse.
Yes.
And obviously you had considerable insight into their situations. But did you draw anything from them? Did you see new aspects of the issues by having to address the needs and problems and situations created by other victims, other survivors?
So one thing, it was all familiar to me, honestly, coming in contact with some of these children. Their stories were kind of the same as my story, you know, as far as why they weren't speaking out and the abuse that was happening and the fact that it was common. But I think that when I was able to remove them, I saw the aspect of the issues with their parents. And I had never saw that aspect, you know, that their parents had been through abuse, that there may have been, you know, more to the story. And I was able to see every aspect versus when I was taken out of my mother's home, I only saw my angle. I only saw what occurred with me. And when they would go to the group homes and go away to the system, when I went into the system, I felt like I didn't have support. I felt like I was just another child that came in that they just fed, clothed to get through the process of whatever they were doing. There was never that desire to like help me heal. And they force you to just like sit in these therapist offices and things like that. But I felt like a lot of the people that I came in contact with on that journey had never been through what I've been through. Right. So they really couldn't meet me from a compassionate standpoint. It was more from a psychological standpoint. And I felt like it was unimpactful for me.
So would they have picked up maybe subconsciously that you were a survivor yourself?
I always spoke out about my story when I came in contact with people. I was always willing to share it. I felt like that was the only glimpse of hope, even if I can only talk to them for the 10 minutes and transporting them or arresting them. And then I think one day I came in contact with someone who actually was an abuser, but he couldn't figure out why. And he was expressing that frustration as if why he couldn't understand why he felt the way that he felt. And then when, you know, the time of me transporting him to the jail, you know, he confessed that he was abused. Right. Right. And so I was able to see that there was a cycle and there was healing that he had never been able to go through. And at the time, I didn't know of what to say or what to, you know, give him per se, or even to the mother who had been abused and just had become so numb to it that she couldn't confront her children being abused because she had never dealt with her own abuse. And so it was just so much uncertainty for me because it was so many different angles. You have the abuser aspect, you have the parent aspect who refuses to protect their child, and then you have the abusee. And so it was just, it was so much to me, and it was such a great dynamic that being a police officer, I just felt like I wasn't as effective as I thought I was going to be in that field. I still felt like I was just pushing these people to the different places they need to go, and then I move on to the next thing. Yeah. And so, yeah, I was able to see that, and I took it home daily, and I always wanted to just feel like there's something else. There has to be something else I can do.
That's fascinating. What do your colleagues think about your insights and your experiences and your knowledge?
So the funny thing is, when I spoke about wearing a mask, I never told any of my colleagues my story. I never let them know that I was a victim because I just didn't want to be viewed as one. I didn't want them to look at me as like the poor girl who was sexually abused and let's have pity on her. I didn't want that image. So I hid my trauma from, you know, the people that I worked with unless I had a really deep, close relationship and I felt comfortable, you know, giving them certain details. But for the most part, I didn't really tell anybody. I walked around as if, you know, they knew I overcame something. They knew I had a struggle and a hard background, but they didn't know the details.
So how do you make that, well, it seems to me, an enormous jump from police officer to novelist?
So it wasn't by choice. My choice was always to continue my career in law enforcement. And I would say in 2019, I got to the place in my life to where I was just so lost and confused and just felt like someone who was just ineffective. And I felt useless at this point in my life. I just felt like I wasn't really doing anything. And I realized I had never really dealt with my trauma. I just covered it up with material things and surface things that really didn't deal with the issue. It just helped me hide, you know, from it. And in 2019, I hit my breaking point to where once I left Cincinnati and got here to Austin, I contemplated suicide. And that contemplation ended up going into action to where the day I made up my mind to actually commit suicide, on my way home to do it, my son was at school and they found him in a bathroom attempting suicide. And I ended up having to go to the school. I had to stop what I was doing, go to the school, get my son. And I had realized in that moment that the fact that I refused to confront the things that I was dealing with, my son was experiencing it in a different level. You know, he was able to feel the depression I was going through. It was showing in the fact that I couldn't really, you know, interact with my children. And I felt like it was important at that time that I began to speak out about what I had been through. And I never thought that that would turn into like a book and me actually speaking to different people and the platform that I've, you know, that's been built now. I just thought it was just me seeking healing and seeking, you know, freedom from that abuse and talking about it so that my children wouldn't have to battle it, because I saw that that was the issue. It was like generational. I learned that my mother had been abused, my grandmother had been abused. And when it hit my son, I saw the importance of me actually not being a victim anymore, but becoming a survivor and becoming a victor and being somebody that was impactful and helping other people go through the same thing.
Danielle and I were talking to a survivor the other day, a young survivor. And this survivor had made disclosures of abuse many, many years ago, but had only told part of the story. And so this particular survivor, I think it's fair to say, Danielle, agree with me or disagree with me, was just going round and round in circles. And I think was potentially causing themselves a lot of damage. They need to be shown, I think that's the right way of putting it, they need to be shown that they don't have to continue to go round and round in circles, and that they are in a position to control the situation that they're in and actually do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of where I got to, is like I was going in circles, you know, because you really don't know the steps that it takes to heal, because most of the people you come in contact with won't really tell you their story. They won't really tell you the deep, impactful parts of your story. And then for me, I despised therapy because I felt like I would sit in these people's office and they would just watch their clock, listen to me talk, and then just leave me home to just, you know, deal with what I was experiencing. I never felt like there was someone who was willing to be vulnerable and be transparent that can say like, hey, this is what I went through specifically, so that I can have that connection with them and be able to connect and say, okay, this person understands where I'm coming from. They can actually help me. Because when you're abused, it feels like an isolated incident. Like, you know that other people have been abused, but you feel like what has happened to you has only happened to you. And you begin to internalize and look at yourself and say, what is wrong with me that this had to happen to me? And so when I decided to speak out, I didn't want to do it in the ordinary way, because that way wasn't helpful. Many of the people that I knew that had been abused, that wasn't the way that they were able to be reached. But when they were able to see someone else be vulnerable, be transparent, tell the dirty parts of their story, not just, you know, the glorious parts of how their transformation happened, but somebody who could take them along the journey, they were able to connect with my story and were able to connect with what I had been through. And then that's where they were able to find hope. And as a child, I never was able to find anybody that wasn't hiding behind a mask, you know, that wasn't hiding behind their money, their success, and all these different things, as if that was the fix-all, like that fixed them as a person. But willing to tell you the parts of their journey, like the parts where they cried, the parts where they were miserable, the parts where it was hard, like sharing the deep, intimate details of what they had been through and their trauma and the way that it made them feel. So that way I can feel like, well, me feeling like this isn't just me. It's a part of the journey, you know, and it's okay. And be able to be okay with the way that I responded to my trauma. But I felt like everyone made me seem like I had to be this person, like, it's okay, it's all for a reason, it's all for a purpose, but not speak to those parts of me that couldn't believe that. And that's what I wanted to do for people.
Yeah. Do you think, Danielle, that chimes with that particular survivor that you were having to basically show them the path to travel down the other day?
Yeah, I think it does. And I mean, I don't know if you agree with this, Janita, that there's certain parts that, like, a client potentially may disclose to police enforcement, maybe the physical abuse, but because there's a stigma behind sexual abuse, sometimes clients, especially if it's a family member or a close relative or family friend, will only give, you know, the bare minimal details, and they keep that other element, you know, maybe the element that they are embarrassed about, you know, back. I don't know if you've experienced that.
Yeah, I have. And I've done that. So my abuse was predominantly my stepfather, but there were cousins and other relatives that did abuse me. And some of those people, I cared about them. I loved them. Like, I wanted them to stop, but I also didn't want to get them in trouble. So in order for me to kind of like protect their image, it was like, I want something done. So let me give the details that will make this a little safer, you know, of an ending, versus the end all be all, where if I say that this person sexually abused me, they can go away forever and then their image is tainted, you know, especially in the family, if there's somebody who's respected in the family. And then you deal with the manipulation and the way that the other family members make you feel by speaking out on this member. So now you are ostracized, you're abandoned by other family members because you spoke out about a person that they cared about. So it's this whole dynamic of just protecting someone else's image, and you will give certain details, but if you really told the deep parts of their secret, it will ruin the whole dynamic of the family and what do you have. Because I've learned that most of the abuse that people go through is with family members, it's not with strangers. And so that part was hard for me because I felt like I had to keep certain secrets. Like, I revealed certain details about, like, maybe my stepfather because I didn't care so much about him. But the people that I cared about that actually abused me for a long time, I wouldn't tell people about them because I didn't want to hurt their image or hurt the relationship that other people had with them. And then I learned as I got along the way that me keeping secrets for them is only killing me. It's hurting me because I'm trying to protect their image all in while they're living their life, but I'm stuck without being able to heal.
Yeah. Which is that continuous cycle on and on and on until somebody or something enables the, you know, the victim, the survivor, to be empowered to break it.
Yeah. And that's kind of what happened with me. And that's the subtitle of my book, is just breaking free from the generational curses, because it was a cycle. It occurred way before me. It occurred before my mother, my grandmother. And it was a cycle that was just being passed down and passed down. And we're all falling into these bad habits and these bad, you know, ways of handling our trauma and what we're going through. And I said, I don't know exactly how breaking it looks like. And if speaking out is the beginning of like open that door to expose everything, because I feel like an underexposed enemy is a threat to everybody. And I wanted to point that enemy out and expose him to everybody in my family, everyone, to show them like, if I expose this enemy, he can no longer secretly attack. He can no longer just sneak into different places because everyone knows that he's there. And so that's kind of the way that I saw it. If I expose this enemy, my son won't walk into this situation blind. My daughter won't walk into, you know, life blind. They will know what it looks like and they will know how to avoid it and what to do if that was ever to be presented to them.
Just to say, in your story, and that's part of your bio in your book, you're saying about breaking the generation. When you were younger, when did you find out about your mother and your grandmother's stories?
So my grandmother, when I was younger, I was raised by her in the beginning parts of my life, maybe up until I was four. But I really didn't get her story until like my teen years. I think like close to my teen, she told me about like she was abused, but she never went into details. She told me she had a hard childhood. You know, she was abused and she left it at that. And then when I got older, I would say I became an adult. That's when my abuse came out and it was like this big thing in my family because everyone found out and we ended up going, you know, to custody. Then it was when, OK, well, you could have told me and I've been through this and I've been through that. And so that's when she kind of told me her story. But I really didn't find out a lot of the things about my mom. Like I said, she kept it very vague, too. Like she had been abused. It never was details. It never was, OK, what kind of abuse? But when I began to write my story, I felt like I couldn't tell my story without telling hers as well. And so I just began to go back and just try to, you know, get her to trust me, you know, let her know that I forgave her. And as I began to walk in that forgiveness with her, she felt more comfortable to share her story. And that's when I began to get details of exactly what she went through and who did it. Because before she wasn't really willing to tell me those things. But as she saw my path of healing and how I was beginning to heal my boldness and my courage, I believe that gave her some type of inspiration to finally speak out.
Fantastic, but fantastic for all the wrong reasons, if you know what
yeah.
I mean.
Yes, I understand.
You have to choose. You say, is that the right word in this context?
Yeah.
Because you can never find the right words sometimes when you're talking about this, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So talking about the book, how do you sit down and write the first page? You've got a blank piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
How do you start writing a novel?
So a couple years ago, it began with me just writing everything that happened. It just everything that I could remember that happened to me, I just put it down on paper. There was like no format to it. It was just me just using my iPhone and in my notes, just typing everything that I could remember as far back as I can go. And it wasn't with the intention to make it into a book. It was just let me get everything out and let me write it down. And then it became to point to where I started to, you know, watch YouTube videos on how to write a book. I bought a book that was began writing the book and I never understood those things. And then I thought about, OK, how can I make my book interesting and for people to read when I decided, OK, we need to make this a book. And I started with the most impactful incident. And my goal was to go back and just get to the beginning to make it kind of like when you're watching TV, make it just interesting for someone to read and follow along. And so it just started with me writing the most impactful thing. And I was going to go back to the beginning. But then the beginning ended up being my mother's story. I didn't know it was going to go back that far. I was just going to start at my beginning and I started at her. So it just was started with me writing. And then once I decided, you know what, I'm going to make this a book. I bought me a laptop, opened up Pages, and I just started typing. And like I said, at the time, I didn't know how to write a book. I didn't know what the spacing was supposed to be, what the font size was supposed to be. It was just, let me just write this down. And then I ended up running into someone who was in a course that teaches you how to write a book. And I joined an online course, and that's when the formatting and everything began. So I went back, and everything that I had, I structured it as chapters. I structured it in the form of going back and just, you know, self-editing it and making it sound better, making the story more appealing. When I started writing the book, everything else just kind of came to me. It just was like things start falling in my lap to help me, you know, further advance it. But it just started with me just writing it down. I didn't think about the bigger picture. It was just I wanted to get my story from here onto paper, from my mind onto paper.
And did you find that therapeutic? Because I know a lot of therapy methods are to write or journal in respect of past trauma. Did that help you?
It definitely was therapeutic. There were times where I would be writing and just break down crying. because there were certain things that would come back to my memory that I had forgot even happened. And so then when I remember something, I realized that this thing that I pushed all the way to the back of my mind was affecting me in my present life. And I had never remembered that I had pushed it so far back in my mind that it was just like a thought that I just let pass by. And as those things started to come back up, because sometimes we don't want to go that far back because we're afraid of what it might reveal, I just, with courage, just went back and just pulled everything to the forefront that I could remember, that I, even if it was things that I did, I just pulled it all to the front and I just confronted it by putting it on paper. And the confrontation to me was having to read it and having to relive it and experience it. And sometimes I would have to stop and pray. There will be times to where I couldn't write. I just need a couple of days to kind of process what actually occurred. And I would just pray about it and find a way to release it in my own way, whether that was going outside and screaming at God for my anger that he let this happen, whether it was crying and sobbing on the shower floor, whatever it was, I just allowed that journey to take its course. And I considered that it wasn't that I was still broken. It was just, I was healing, you know, it was like my way of just healing and bridging that gap. And so it definitely was a therapeutic experience. And once it was all said and done, I just sat back in deep awe and, you know, affirmation for what it was that I had actually accomplished.
I have a corny question for you.
Yeah.
Are you healed?
I believe I'm still healing. It's so much of a dynamic. Like there are certain parts that I have healed from, but I believe that healing is a lifelong process. It's not just some, you know, course or method you can take to where it all goes away. But I know how to handle it properly. Like when the memories come where it wants me to react a certain way in situations, I choose differently now, you know? So like right now, I feel like God is working in my marriage, that some of the trauma that I experienced that I never confronted when I got into the marriage that affected it in the beginning. Now we have to go back to square one and kind of break down some of those walls and heal in those areas. So I believe that healing is a lifelong process. There may be certain issues that I've healed from, but I feel like there's certain things that because of my trauma that I made choices in my adult life due to my trauma.
So you taught yourself to find a way to heal.
Yeah. I mean, but most of my method is just a lot of prayer and meditation and reflection, self-reflection. When you're trying to heal, you have to be willing to confront the parts of you that you allow to change because of your trauma. Like there are certain attitudes that we have and we be like, this is just us. This is how I am. So people have to accept it.
Self-reflection's hard, isn't
it? It is.
Some years ago, to try and become a better lawyer, better person, whatever, I did some basic training in therapy, become a therapist. So I did the basic. And you have to self-reflect. If you're going to be trying to provide therapy to other people, you have to self-reflect. And self-reflection is tough.
It's vulnerable. It puts you in a very vulnerable place because you also have to have conversations of exposing yourself that you don't want to have. You know, it's a very vulnerable thing because you've been so guarded. Most people who experience some type of trauma, you guard certain parts of yourself. And in order to heal, you have to take off those guards and just trust the process. And you have to become exposed and be willing to take the steps because you can't heal if you're protecting yourself at this. Like you can't protect yourself and release at the same time. You have to do one or the other.
Yeah. At the start of this, I said, I've got nothing to self-reflect on. There's, you know, so the person who I had to do the self-reflection with sort of raised eyebrows and threw a question at me. And away we went. And after a couple of experiences of this, I was thinking, I wasn't very happy. But then you have to work your way through it. And actually, it all of a sudden, something clicks.
Yeah.
And you start to see the benefit and you can work things out. You can work things out, but you have to follow through. If you just stop, you don't get the benefit. Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, when I used to try to experience healing, the moment that it began to hurt, I ran from it. And I was like, you know what? Nope. Let's close that back up. Let's put that back for another time. I'm not ready to feel that. I'm not ready to experience that. I'm not ready to confront that. And fear caused me to just put it back up. And so the first time I truly just opened that box and allowed whatever emotions came, whatever feelings came, whatever thoughts came, I would try my hardest to work through it. And as I did that with the first thing and I came out, I was like, oh, okay, so that wasn't so bad. So let's take the next step. Let's try something else. Let's try another area. So it's definitely that journey, but no one wants to feel exposed. No one wants to be seen as vulnerable. No one wants to experience that, because some people will take advantage of your vulnerability. But that's where you have to be able to recognize the people that, when you're in your healing stage, you have to know who to remove from your life and who to keep there while you're in that stage, because it's very important, because that person can influence what it is that you do in your healing. So there were certain people I had to isolate myself from, not because I didn't love them, not because I didn't want them in my life, but I needed my opportunity to heal. I need to give myself a fair shot and a fair chance at actually healing. And this person would divert me back and make me afraid of doing that, because when I become vulnerable and exposed, they attack. And it may not be in a way that's intentional. It may be just what they do and what they've become accustomed to. But in my healing process, it was a very delicate place that I was in life. And when I isolated myself and I healed and I was willing to open back up, I realized that some of those people weren't still there and they didn't need to be. That was the way that, you know, they were removed from my life, not because I pushed them out, but they weren't there. And then I became encircled, I would say encompassed, with people who cared about me, who wanted to protect the place of healing that I got to, who was I was able to be vulnerable with, and then make me feel like something of the unordinary for being vulnerable. And it was definitely a process that was hard, because some people you don't want to let go of. You love them too much. You've built too much time with them. They've been there since, you know, the beginning. But time served does not dictate placement. And that's kind of how I feel. Like, just because you've been there for a certain amount of time, it doesn't mean that you deserve a full-time placement in my life for the rest of my life. You may have just been there for a season. And so some people just didn't match the new person I had became. I wasn't attracted to some of those relationships because of the new person I was becoming.
One last question, Janita, because our 20-minute podcast has turned into a 45-minute podcast.
Yes.
Anyway,
sorry.
So one. No. Anyways, brilliant. Anyway, one last one, and I think Danielle's got one last question. So my last question, and then I'll zip it, which is, why should our audience pick up your novel and read it?
I believe that my novel will expose, in a, like I said, in a vulnerable and transparent way, some of the secrets that was kept, and some of those things that happened in my book, they may be able to connect to it and say those same things happened to me. And they're able to go along with the journey with my book of being able to understand what generational curses look like and what trauma actually looks like, because trauma, even if it's sexual, there's so many different other aspects of what trauma can be. So it's not, my book isn't just about sex abuse. There's, you know, my mother's parents was drug addicts. And so there's so many different dynamics that influences certain decisions. And I believe they will be able to connect with at least certain part. Even if you haven't been through sex abuse, I believe that there's some sort of abuse or something that you may be able to connect with and recognize. But this book is just the first part, and the goal is to make it into a TV series. So if they want to understand a TV series, then I say pick up the book so that you can follow along.
Brilliant. Okay. And Danielle's got one last question for you, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, my question was just to see, now the book's been released and obviously, you know, you've disclosed quite a lot about yourself. What's the response been like? Have you had people that have disclosed to you, or has it helped others to your knowledge so far?
I believe I've gotten the best of both worlds. Outside of my family, there's so many people who have, you know, called me or inboxed me or just sent me messages and just thanked me for my courage, because I've given them the courage to speak out and understand that it's okay to speak out. And the message that I push, as far as, you know, the secrets we keep, you know, now only hurts future generations. And I believe that those messages of, you know, your healing is more important than your image has been, you know, really resonating with a lot of people, and they're able to see it modeled, you know, through someone, not just here's a fancy quote, but they're able to see the model of it. And so many people have just, you know, reached out to just ask questions of my process and just be able to see my journey, and it's given them the freedom and ability to speak out. And then for some of my people, my family that had the wrong message, you know, they believed lies that some of these abusers told because I never spoke out. They're able to see the truth, and the truth is able to be revealed. And it may have ruined some relationships. It may have caused conflict, but I believe that's still the beginning of healing. So I believe I got the exact response that I wanted. And as my audience began to grow and as the message began to get pushed, I believe that more people would be affected by it.
Thank you, Janita.
Thank you.
It's been absolutely great having you on. And so thank you, podcast listeners. Thank you for tuning in once again. And as always, If you have questions or concerns, then please don't hesitate to get in touch with us. We're always happy to talk to you in confidence if necessary. And please join us next week for our next podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. If you'd like to speak to us about something you've heard today, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.